Okay, we finished off in the last class on this statement, therefore you shall be perfect. Some versions say you must be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. And it's good to spend a little time asking yourself how you feel about that. That the requirement to be in God's kingdom is perfection. Because if that freaks you out, it means you still have some of this mosaic structure hanging onto your brain. Okay? You must be perfect. And we read in Hebrews earlier that we're looking to Mount Zion and the city filled with righteous men made perfect. The perfection that's going to come is going to come from God. And we did see, however, that keeping the law cannot be equated with righteousness. Righteousness is too big to be codified in any particular way. And we see this, in regular human law, the volumes of law are such that nobody actually knows all the laws that there are in North America right now. Because they're trying to codify what is good to the nth and ultimate degree. And it's impossible. They keep adding new ones and they don't get rid of the old ones, and it's just crazy, right? We're sinking under the weight of our own legal code. And Jesus is not doing that to the law of Moses. He isn't adding a second legal code. He's saying righteousness is outside of the legal code. Now, we skipped over, or kind of glossed over, a phrase where Jesus was talking about loving our enemies. And Jesus said, if you love those who love you, what reward have you? And he's introducing a concept here subtly that we're going to talk about in more detail, which is reward. When we go to do something, there are consequences to the actions that we take. And so, for instance, I have 5 kids, and I love those kids. And love is a noble, religious attribute. Therefore, because I have this noble religious attribute within myself, I must be a righteous person, is the way my brain might work. Does anybody know who this is? Her name is Ava Braun. Anybody know who Ava Braun is?
Kevin's girlfriend.
He did marry her at the very end, I think the day before the end. This is Hitler's girlfriend. And to all reports, he loved her. Okay? Now, does that make Hitler a righteous man? Because he had within his soul this good religious attribute of loving somebody else. And of course, we go, well, no. That's fine. We're happy to take Hitler's love and throw it away. But when we look at our own love, are we quite so discerning on what the rewards are of the actions that we undertake? And Jesus says a very insightful question, what are you doing more than others? So Hitler's a human being, and he displayed a human being amount of love. And you're a human being, and if you display that human being amount of love, well, all you're saying is you're a human being. All humans tend to have certain love for certain things. And if that's your love, don't give yourself any credit for it. It's biological. It's just the nature of the beast, right? Righteousness doesn't live in there. And therefore, we have another shocking conclusion. We were shocked at the beginning of this by the suggestion that law did not necessarily mean righteousness. And now Jesus is saying, you know what? Love doesn't necessarily mean righteousness either. You know, the foundation of all religions, people say, is love. And what Jesus is saying, love is not the definition of righteousness. We begin chapter 6 with the word beware. Beware. Why do they put a sign like beware somewhere? You go somewhere and they say beware. What motivates somebody to put that sign up? I'm so shy. Danger. They might just say danger if there's danger. What is it specifically that would choose them to say beware as opposed to just danger?
The dog could be behind the fence.
Pardon me?
The dog could be behind the fence.
There's a dog, yes, but there's something about the danger.
You can prevent it. You can get away from it.
You can prevent it, but you might not notice it if it's not for the sign. Right? Beware, like if there's a huge dog growling at the gate, you know, and charging against it, well, you don't need a sign that says beware of dog. I can see the dog, right? It's intuitive to me. But sometimes the dog is sleeping. And so I come up to the gate and I can't see a dog, and I think this is a non-dangerous situation, when in fact it is. And that's why somebody puts up the sign that says beware of dog, because this is a situation which appears safe, but actually has a hidden danger within it. And so when Jesus starts this chapter saying, beware, he's telling us that we have a tendency to see things safely that are not in fact safe. Okay? So what is the thing that we have a tendency to see as safe that in fact isn't? And that is, to sum up most of the chapter, anything that makes us look good to other people is automatically suspect, which is awfully scary. Any form of religiosity which is witnessed by another person is instantly suspect. It's not to say that we shouldn't do it, but it's to say we should beware, because beware of what you're thinking about yourself, what your own image is about your righteousness. And Jesus is saying, you can't trust that as much as you think you can. Charity, for instance, I mean, giving food to poor people, how could that not be righteousness? Right? And Jesus is saying, you know what? That is not necessarily, it's not that it's bad to give food to poor people. It's just that if you're trying to evaluate your own righteousness on the basis of whether you give food to poor people, there is a risk in your thinking. There is a risk. Prayer, again, maybe next to charity prayer, you know, it's very religious to pray. But if you're doing it publicly, Jesus says, be careful. And I'm going to use self-sacrifice here instead of fasting. We'll come back to fasting later. But the key point is that why are we doing the thing that we are doing, is what Jesus is asking. What is the reward of this action? And if you love your family and they love you back, fantastic. I mean, Jesus is not against that. Okay? But he's saying, you got the reward. You scratched their back, and they scratched yours, and now everybody's even. God is not part of this transaction. It's a perfectly fine transaction, but God isn't a part of it. Don't deceive yourself into thinking God is part of this transaction. And in the same way, if you give to charity, but do it in such a way that it is noticed, beware, because God might not be involved in that transaction. You might be buying an image that you find personally satisfying. And that's fine. If you want to do that, spend your money that way, go for it. Okay? It's not that he's against charity. It's just that you risk deceiving yourself about your own righteousness. So motives matter. Okay, we talked about keeping the law, thou shalt not kill. But why aren't you killing matters. It's not just whether you don't kill, it's why. Why are you behaving this way? Which has an interesting side effect, that there is no such thing as accidental righteousness, right? You can't accidentally be righteous because there's no motive. There's an absence of motive, and if motive is a crucial ingredient in actual righteousness, you can't be accidentally righteous. So we have this lady who was yelling at herself in the bathroom, and she was drunk, and her husband, who was also drunk, yelled at her to stop yelling so that the neighbors wouldn't be upset, she went into the kitchen and grabbed a knife and, you know, ran at him in a stabbing rage and stabbed him in the chin and embedded the knife in his chest. And it's a testament to his drunkenness that he then went and lay down and fell asleep on his bed. But luckily for him, the neighbors had in fact heard this commotion and had called the police. And the police came and they carried him off, you know, bleeding profusely. He went to the hospital. And the surgeons were stitching him up. And they noticed that his liver had a horrible condition because his wife had helpfully opened up his chest cavity and it saved his life. Okay, this lady's a lifesaver. If she hadn't attacked her husband in a fit of drunken rage, her husband would have died of liver disease. And in fact, that was when her husband recovered, he went to court and he tried to get her not to go to jail because he mentioned that all this good came out of her action. He was alive because of her actions. The court did not agree. But the point is, right, good came out of those actions, but the motive was entirely absent, and so we don't consider that to be righteous. So this is a rather clear and semi-comical case, but we have here a doctor in Burkina Faso helping children. Okay, that's a good act, and good comes of it. Where is God in the motives of this man? And I actually don't know who he is personally, so he might be there, but the point is we can't tell from this picture what were the motives that took this man to Burkina Faso to help children. And they may be fantastic motives, and it's good, and I want people to go to Burkina Faso and help people, but is righteousness involved in this moment? And the answer is, I don't know. Right? You can't tell just by looking. And in fact, in your own minds, when you're looking at yourself, it can be terribly difficult to discern your own motives on why you're behaving in a certain way or conducting certain activities. So, the scary thing is Jesus keeps redefining righteousness on us. And in this case, he's saying righteousness is doing what God wants, but not just doing what God wants, but because God wants it. And that we wouldn't otherwise do it. Okay? So if it's natural for you and you get a good social feeling from coming to a congregation on a Sunday morning and hearing positive messages and having potlucks, and that's what you like in life, then it's not religious that you're doing it. I mean, it may unfold in a church, in a religious organization, but God is not actually involved. So it's almost like the Catch-22 book, right? The only time it's righteous is that Sunday morning when you don't want to go there. Because that Sunday morning, you changed your fleshly behavior. Now, if you changed it because your mother would get you in trouble, then that's not righteous either, right? You have to change it because God wanted you to do it. And if you change that behavior because God wanted you to do it, and you wouldn't have otherwise got out of bed that morning and gone to meeting or done that action, there's righteousness, right? But in the routine forms of life, in our social circles, it can be very hard to actually tell when our motives are truly pure. So let's come back to charity. Do we know from Scripture any cases where charity can be problematic? And if you go to the book of Acts, we get Ananias and Sapphira, right? Some mixed motives there. It was entirely okay for them to sell their property and donate the money to charity. That's okay. It would have been okay for them not to sell their property and not donate it for charity. It was not an imposition, right? It's that they sold their property and they said they donated it to charity, but actually didn't. And this is back to keeping a little bit back and in the subject twos, but they wanted more payback than they were actually wanting to pay. They wanted the image more than they wanted to live it. And so charity can do that to us. We have to be very cautious when we get into charity. The thing that Jesus is trying to address in this section is something unambiguously righteous. And Melissa got me in trouble for using such long words on this slide, but is something unambiguously righteous. And there is a philosophy out there that says, yes, some things are unambiguously righteous, and that giving money to poor people is always righteous, and that praying is always righteous, and that heroic self-sacrifice is always righteous. And the point that Jesus is making here is that is not always the case. Okay, there are consequences sometimes that you don't expect. Jesus himself was charitable, and he fed 5,000. And in the next chapter, he says, truly, truly, I say to you, you are seeking me, not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves. So even Jesus' own charitable actions sometimes had consequences that he wished they wouldn't. Right? You're giving away free food, and then the next chapter, Jesus is going, man, you're here for the free food. You're not here for the message. And I want you to be here for the message. This happens in Africa with food aid. I think, did I get a slide for that? Yeah, so there'll be an area of Africa that is short on food, so the United Nations or whatever will come in and they'll flood the area with huge shipments of grain, which is fantastic for the people who are hungry today, but guess what happens to the agricultural economy of that area? Absolutely destroyed. Every local farmer who has been making, you know, eking out a living, growing food, is instantly out of business because there are warehouses full of free food, so nobody comes and buys their food. So they stop farming and take up a different profession so they can feed their family with the free food that the UN supplies. And a year later, 2 years later, the area is more impoverished and more dependent on aid than it was before they started. Okay, does that mean we shouldn't give to poor places? No, it doesn't mean that, but it means you have to think about it, right? You have to think it through, and you have to be wise about it. You can't just kind of throw stuff in there and say, well, no, because I'm throwing money at Africa, I'm a good person and I'm doing good deeds. It doesn't work that way. We had this in the mission field. I grew up in El Salvador, and there's a tendency of North Americans, you know, our income up here is vastly, you know, proportionally greater than incomes down there. And people would show up and they would love to spend money to help people down there. And they walk around with big wads of cash and offer to do stuff. And culturally, it was devastating, right? It changes the whole structure of the group. Who's in charge of the money? Who gets to decide where the money gets spent? You're talking about amounts of money that are in great multiples of your annual income, and there's conflict in the group now on how to spend it and where. And it, you know, there's ways to help, and there's ways that can be more damaging. And just because you're giving doesn't make it good. You actually have to give responsibly. And in Acts chapter 6, we have the other side of the equation, that it's not right that we should give up preaching the word of God to serve tables. So they were having arguments in the early church about charity, and the point that they arrived at is that we do have priorities in our community, and actually, charity isn't the first priority. It's a big priority. It's an important priority. We're going to take 7 of our best people and put them in charge of it, but that is not why we're here. Okay? There are lots of groups that can provide charity. There's only one group that can provide the word of God. Okay? And so the degree that we pursue charity, we have to make sure it is not taking us away from our primary mandate. And this is very difficult in the modern era because charity is one of the acceptable behaviors of religion in modern society. Religion is losing its reputation, okay? Especially among the younger generation coming up. Religion has a bad reputation, a lot of it learned. But one of the things that the humanist society around us approves us of is us giving money to charity, which is great. And we should. But we've got to be careful that that doesn't become our religion so that we can feel righteous and also be ingratiated to the society around us so that we're all on the same team, we're all trying to make the world a better place. Right? And the details of the gospel, well, maybe we can find that on our own. Okay. Prayer, and I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on prayer because this is a subject that could take a whole set of classes all on its own. But one of the things that really jumps out at me in one of the verses here, and this is true of this whole section, this is, I think, verse 6. But you, when you pray, go into your room, and when you have shut your door, pray to your Father who is in the secret place, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. Do you think Jesus is trying to emphasize something in this passage? In the broader section, this you, you, and your, 42 times in the space of a dozen or so verses. What is he saying? He's saying some parts of your religion are private. This is actually about you and your God. And it's not about your brother or somebody else in the community watching you do it. You need to do this for yourself in your own space with God. It is not a public thing automatically. So I'll leave prayer there for now and jump to fasting. Fasting is challenging for me because in all my years of growing up in the Christadelphian community, I have never, to my recollection, attended a Bible class or a study or a talk or an exhortation or a lecture where anybody has ever suggested that we should be fasting as part of our religious observance. Which, when I see Jesus grouping it as, charity, obviously part of religion, and prayer, obviously part of religion, and fasting, we don't do that. I'm worried about that a little bit. It has the wheels turning for me. Like, what happened to fasting? How come we kind of left that part out? One of the things we pride ourselves as being is a first century ecclesia. We try to organize ourselves the way they did, 2,000 years ago. Well, 2,000 years ago, they fasted. And this is Jesus talking about fasting. And he starts off saying, okay, my disciples don't fast. And then he says, but the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast. So yes, there was a period while Jesus was there where they weren't doing fasting, but Jesus says, this is the exceptional period. Once I'm gone, normal religious observance will resume. In Acts 13, verse 2, while they were ministering to the Lord and fasting, it's not making a big deal about the fact that they were fasting, and the reason it's not making a big deal is because it was probably quite ordinary. Just like sometimes it says they pray. It doesn't make a big deal. It's assumed that you pray. It's assumed that people fasted. And they had appointed elders for them in every church. Having prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord. So, I'm worried about why we as a community have somehow, or a society even, have de-emphasized this fasting concept of religious observance. And I almost wonder if it's because it's too simple, sort of too biological, right? It's not sort of high up there enough. There's not any huge concept that you have to understand in order to fast. You just have to not eat, right? It's a pretty basic thing. But it's also a battle with our animal nature, right? There is that animal inside us that wants the treat. And I worry that maybe we try to pretend there isn't an animal inside of us, and that this isn't a problem for us. That we've somehow got this part under control, and it would be kind of redundant to go through the whole fasting thing. But of course, any of you who've been on a diet know that it's a whole lot harder than you think it is to control what you eat. So, certainly Genesis 3:6, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, she took its fruit and ate. The very first recorded sin involved an inability to resist consuming food. Right? Like, of all the sins recorded in history, the very first one starts off at such a basic, primal, biological level. I am hungry, it looks good, and I want it, and so I take it. And we have sort of de-emphasized our battle against that mechanism, and that worries me a little bit. Jesus was baptized. His very first temptation, the very first trial that he faced, involved not eating. Now, Jesus being Jesus, went 40 days, and he had the power to turn stones into bread, so he had a different kind of temptation. But isn't it interesting that the very first test of religiosity was, can you control the animal that's inside you? The basic biological creature that just wants food, it just wants its appetite satisfied. You know, do we put enough emphasis in our community and practical tool sets on how to control our animal nature? You know, when Joseph faced Potiphar's wife, you know, it wasn't about looking up chapter and verse. It wasn't about some esoteric concept that was involved. It was, there's an animal impulse and I have to flee. And when David faced Bathsheba, it's the same thing. There's a fundamental animal impulse, and do I give into it, or do I fight? And there wasn't any verses that David didn't know, right? I mean, he knew what the Bible said. He knew what the right thing to do was. It wasn't a question of ignorance or study or anything like that. It was at the very basic level, was he in control of his animal nature or was he not? And we talk about eye for an eye, and Jesus talks about, you know, thou shalt not kill. The examples that Jesus brings up, so many of them are rooted in core sort of biological reasoning. I'm angry, I'm hungry, I want payback, you know, I'm lustful. Those are the things that Jesus chose to talk about. Why? Because throughout the history of humanity, those basic fundamental things have been the source of most of our downfalls. We kind of like to spend time in the ivory towers, and in some ways that's a safer place to be, and the Pharisees did that as well. They like to tithe the mint, right? It's a mathematical thing. There's so much mint coming through, we're going to take 10%, we know if we've done it, and it doesn't really affect that visceral part of you so much, where Jesus says, no, you know, you got to do justice and mercy, the deeper things. When the Good Samaritan stops to help this man, it's an innately biological form of helping. There's a body there. It's covered in sweat, dirt, and blood, possibly vomit, and you don't even know who it is, and you don't know what else is around, but I'm going to get into the dirty and grody parts of life and touch this guy's wounds, and that is love. Right? That is loving my neighbor, the visceral, the basic, the primal parts. And so I worry about us that we maybe are a tad too clinical in our approach to religion, and we forget within ourselves how potent these biological forces are. Something as simple as hunger, and that they can sort of lead us off the deep end. So stepping back a bit, Jesus has talked about love, he's talked about charity, he's talked about prayer, and he's talked about fasting. And we have to ask the same question we asked about the laws. Are these the only ways in which we can deceive ourselves into thinking that we're righteous? And I don't think that's what Jesus is saying, right? I think he's saying any form of external show that can somehow be interpreted as being righteous, such as me hypocritically up here with a tie, and this has the same danger as giving to charity or excessive prayer or fasting. And it doesn't mean you don't do it, but be aware, every time you put that suit on or you put that tie on, are you thinking you're righteous? Are you thinking that that somehow, you know, ticks a checkbox off somewhere? Because it's an external show of religion. And there is a risk that the reason you're doing it is to impress other people. And if the reason you're doing it is to impress other people, then fair enough. You've impressed other people, you have your reward. But don't think that God is part of that conversation. Right? God is not involved in that transaction. You had a transaction, you had a social transaction. I dressed up, you thought I looked good and was righteous, and we're even, right? I got something, you got something. God was not involved. Are there other things in our community where this can happen? You know, but do we consider some versions of the Bible more righteous than others? There's certain vocabularies, I propose, that are considered more righteous than others. And when we use those vocabularies, are we using them to communicate, or are we using them to demonstrate our righteousness? And Paul famously says, I'd rather speak, was it five words in my own tongue than 1,000 that nobody can understand? So Paul's primary concern was, do people understand what I'm saying? And if our terminology is obfuscating that, we have to go back to the motives. Why are we speaking this way? Are there certain prohibitions that are associated with greater righteousness, right? In Colossians, he says, these are matters which have, to be sure, the appearance of wisdom in self-made religion and self-abasement. We deny ourselves things. No, I would never do that, right? I would never, whatever it is, and I tread lightly because, you know, I'll implicate myself, but if we're bragging about the things that we don't do because we're righteous, then maybe that's not actually righteous, right? Now, if you privately don't, whatever, drink whiskey, because you think that that's, you know, something that a true righteous person wouldn't do, then fair enough to you. But if you walk around talking about how nobody should ever drink whiskey and that everybody drinks whiskey is bad, but you don't drink whiskey, so you're good, then it's self-abasement and severe trouble. Well, not drinking whiskey is not severe trouble, sure. But and obviously all these things are nuances, and there are times where things are appropriate and times when they're inappropriate, and there's a whole wealth of wisdom we can share. But any time we broadcast a behavior that is in any way correlated to righteousness, beware, right? Beware, because it might not be as righteous as you think. There's those motives, and if anywhere in your heart there's the motive of having someone else see that you're righteous, well, you have your reward, and it wasn't righteous. Now, I'm going to make this clear that this isn't actually, nowhere in Jesus' conversation is he talking about pointing fingers. He's not talking about, that guy's charitable, but his charity is not true charity, or that person's prayer is not true prayer, or that person's dress, or that person's. He's not talking about that. He's talking about introspection, about looking at your own behaviors and how you think you might be righteous. Right? The most dangerous thing that can happen is that you think you're more righteous than you are. That leads you down all kinds of terrible roads. He's saying, you need to be suspect. You need to be suspicious of every righteous thing that you do. Not to go out there and be suspicious of everybody else. Okay? That's another form of, we'll talk about that tomorrow. But the point of Jesus is, be suspicious and very cautious about your own behavior. And of course, he offers an antidote. Don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. There's a simple solution that if you want to be sure that your charity comes from pure motives, don't tell anybody. Don't let anybody know. Very simple. And I don't know, have any of you done a big charitable deed and tried not to tell anybody? Done it a few times and I've just ruined it. But it is very hard not to tell people because you're kind of excited and you think it's cool and it's good as well, you know. And I don't know if there's a, you know, in law there's like an exemption with conversation with your wife and your spouse. I forget what it's called. I don't know if there's an exemption here where if I tell my wife and if she thinks I'm righteous, well, that's kind of a reward too. So that's kind of, but you know, so it's a lot more complicated than it looks, but it's for a good cause, which is to avoid self-delusion, right? If you can keep it secret, if you're doing that thing that you believe to be good and you're not crowing about it, and you're not even accidentally letting someone in on your little secret, that is the safest way to be charitable. And of course, what Jesus is trying to avoid is the religion of the Pharisees, which he mentions that they're like graves, right? That outside, they take great care in making sure everything's landscaped and there's great order, and it's a beautiful scene, and it all conceals the fact that underneath are rotting corpses. And we got to make sure that our religion, our personal religion, isn't one of making sure all our exterior hedges are trimmed while inside we've got rotting bodies going on. So, the summary is that motives matter. And when we conduct a charitable act, in this continuum of darkness to light, we don't always know exactly where we stand. There isn't a binary option that says this is good and this is not good. And what it is, it's a lifetime of examining yourself every time you're charitable and saying, can my charity be more pure? Can my charity be more based on what God wants rather than what I want? Motives matter, and mixed motives matter. Yes, it's because God asked me to do it, but it's also because I want to look good. That's a dangerous, dangerous place to be. Okay, the next section that Jesus takes us to is treasures on earth, which has another one of these absolutes. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. How many people here have RSPs or some kind of retirement savings? How many people have bank accounts? Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. So, you know, we're all sinners. And it's another one of these absolutes that we have to go, okay, how do we live? How do we take a lifetime to figure out how to live this message? How do we shift our accounts from earthly accounts to heavenly accounts is basically what Jesus is saying. There's a different accounting system that God keeps track of. And which is more important to you, right? Which one are you actually trying to build up and which one are you not? And oh, here was my RSP slide, sorry. And you might say, why does Jesus go, how did we go from fasting to wealth? What does wealth have to do with fasting? Well, what it has to do is you can't serve God and mammon. It's mixed motivations, right? It's you don't have a single focus in life. You're not saying that that God's the important thing in my life and that's it. You're saying God and my bank account are important to me. And with the fasting and the charity, you're saying God and what the religious community thinks of me is important to me, right? So it's a matter of mixed motives. You can't serve two masters. And an example of this is Solomon's temple, right? He built this fantastic temple, and he put a tremendous amount of wealth into it. And what became, you know, in the fifth year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, the king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem, and he took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house, and he took everything, even taking all the shields of gold that Solomon had made. We have this illusion in wealth that it has some kind of permanence, that it provides some kind of stability, but it is all an illusion. It's really no guarantee that our wealth is going to be here tomorrow. You know, we saw the the crash of 2008, you know, we're in October. October is a deadly month for stock markets and the economic system. We never know if it's teetering or if it's doing all right. We're in uncharted territories, low interest rates for an absurd amount of time, negative interest rates in some places. You know, we don't know. We can't trust in wealth. Anxiety. Now, I was talking to Einar and mentioning that anxiety can become its own entire subtopic. And I don't mean to go into it in huge detail, but it also is in the same question of, is there too many motivations going on in our head? I think is part of the link that Jesus is bringing in. And is this what our brain looks like? You know, trying to go in every direction at the same time, fulfill every objective of life, make sure we're safe in every respect. And maybe what we really need is something more like this. Right? Maybe we just need to simplify and say, hold on, you know, there's other stuff in life, but right now, in front of you, you've got one road, and it's pretty clear. And if you just put all that other stuff aside and focus on the one road, the other stuff can take care of itself. Right? Seek you first the kingdom of God, and all these other things will be added on. But it's so hard in this modern world. We've never been richer and more prosperous, and the suicide rates are through the roof. Right? We have everything, and yet people are on antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication like crazy, right? Because our lives somehow have become too cluttered. We've tried to fill too much and put everything and achieve everything and be everything and do everything. And Jesus is saying, simplify. Simplify, right? When you're doing an act, do it for God. Don't do it for what other people think. You know, don't do it for your wealth. Don't do it for clothing or for safety or for security. If you can simplify your life, then that will help with anxiety. Now, again, it's a complex topic. That's just one element of it. But I know for me this works in terms of, I call it lowering my focus or narrowing my focus. So when I'm anxious, I'm usually worried about where we're going to be in a year, whether our company's still going to be in business, whether I'm going to be employed, how my health is going to be, where my kids are going to be, how are they doing, and my relationship with them, and all this stuff in broad terms, and it becomes overwhelming and you're paralyzed. And if I just go, what am I going to do right now? Like, literally, what do I need to do in the next 10 minutes? And I make that time scale as small as I need to feel like I can handle it again. And if I bring it down to 10 minutes, what can I do in 10 minutes? And sometimes the answer is nothing. It's like, okay, well then I'm gonna do nothing for 10 minutes. I mean, what can I do in the next 10 minutes? And sometimes you can extend it to an hour. Okay, I'm worried I'm neglecting child number 4. Well, in an hour, I can go do something about that. Do a little thing. It's not gonna fix the problem. Now, what can I do about my job? Well, in the next hour, I can't actually do anything about my job. It's not working hours. Right? It's 2 o'clock in the morning. So put that aside, right? Bring the focus back down to just the simplest thing. What can I actually do for God now? Right now. And then do it. Right? Do that one thing. And then after that, there'll be something else. And that's one way, I think, that we can kind of bring the clutter down to something that's manageable. There's other verses that talk about this. You know, Luke chapter 10, 41. Jesus answered and said unto her, Martha, Martha, you are careful and troubled about many things, but one thing is needful. Right? She's got all this stuff going on, and Jesus is saying, it's too much. Like, you're trying to take on too much. It's your choice. You've chosen to take on all these things. You don't have to do that. You absolutely do not have to do that. One thing is needful. And there's a passage, I don't know if I put the verse, I'll come back to that other one, but in Psalm 37, there's a series of verses that say, fret not, and they talk about what you shouldn't fret about, and then the counter set of verses says, trust in the Lord. And that's the other thing, is that you worry about stuff, And you worry and you worry, and the antidote to worry is trust. And it's so much easier to say than to do, and I absolutely understand that. And it's true for me too. I go, I don't want to, you know, have all these things happen. And what's going to happen if all this happens? But if I trust, if I actually truly trust, then I know that God's going to be, that it's going to be okay. God's going to take care of me. And a lot of the time I go, why doesn't that make me happy? It's because I want to take care of myself. God might take care of me by taking me over there, but I want to be taken care of in that direction. And that's where my anxiety is coming from, right? I have this little stippy, this little subject twos that I've attached to God taking care of me. I haven't fully let go and say, God, you can take care of me wherever it goes, like as long as it's down this door here. So that's part of trying to grow. But this is, again, the endless journey, right? And I had this little Facebook thing, because this is another source of anxiety in the younger generation. But somebody changes their profile picture, and 50-plus people like it. And we get a long train of, what a beauty, of course, beautiful, oh, thank you, gorgeous, stunning. I love, you know. Now this person at least said, lovely inside and out. There was at least a token person who said, you know what, your appearances aren't the only thing that matters. You know, they're only half of what matters. And you go, what are we doing to our young people when we're underlining to them that your appearance matters, because your appearance is going to change, and it's and people's definition of what is a reasonable appearance is going to change, and that's going to be a tremendous source of anxiety for a lot of people. Don't feed this, is my plea. Try not to feed it. Okay, I know you want to be nice, and I want to compliment somebody, but it sets them up for dangerous expectations. So fret not, trust in the Lord. And I'm going long, and I know I'm going to be in trouble later. So let me do a quick summary of where we're at, and that is, this isn't a rules-based religion. Okay, you should be broken of that by now. And if you haven't been broken of that, go back and read chapter 5 again. Right to the end, make sure you read that last verse carefully, because you must be perfect. And until you can get past that, you got to let go of rules being your definition of righteousness. And you got to get rid of appearance being a definition of righteousness. Just because things look good doesn't make them good. We've got to look at our motivation. And that's where the true test lies. Righteousness isn't a checkbox. It's a lifelong quest towards perfection. So I want to end with a little parable. Suppose that you are a master craftsman in charge of making wooden boxes. You have a long experience in making wooden boxes. You make them every day. You get up every day. You work on wooden boxes, and you kind of enjoy it. And one day your boss comes in and he says, I've got a new tool for you. It's a laser level. Okay? So with this fancy tool, you can put it on your box and you can instantly tell whether your corners are aligned properly and whether your surfaces are all smooth or not, and whether it's really perfect in every respect. So ask yourself, how do you feel right now about your boss dropping in and giving you this tool? Okay? Because there's two different ways you can react to your boss coming in. And one is, oh, great, right? It's just going to show all the problems with my boxes. And he's going to sit there and he's going to look over my shoulder and say, that box isn't good enough, that box isn't good enough, that box isn't good enough, right? And every time I make a box, it's going to be inevitable that it's going to be flawed in some way. And I hate that feeling. I don't want to feel inadequate. And so depending on your relationship with your boss and what you think your boss thinks of box making and how you get on, how you see him and his relationship with you, that can be how you react to your boss's intervention. But what if you're just a craftsman who loves making boxes and wishes in his heart that every box you made was perfect? Okay? And what if you knew that your boss bought into that same message and that he was going to support you in your quest to make better boxes? If that's how you think of your boss, and he comes in with this tool, what are you going to think? Awesome. This is great. Because this tool is going to give me more information about how to make better boxes. Right? I'm going to have a treasure trove. I'm going to have a lifetime of improving my box making craft thanks to this tool that my boss has given me. Okay? And so, we are those craftsmen. And Jesus has come, and he's given us a measuring tool in the Sermon on the Mount. And what we've been doing is lining ourselves up to it and finding out that we're off kilter, and our corners don't line up properly, and the surfaces aren't smooth. And we're looking at it going, this is a pretty rigorous instrument. You know? In order to actually pass this instrument's test, we've got to be perfect. And what are we going to do about this instrument? Because if we're in a legalistic, I've got a hard boss, difficult man mentality, we're going to try not to use that instrument because it's going to make us feel bad and it's going to make us worry about our relationship with our boss and what our boss is going to think about if he sees that we're failing. But if we've got a loving relationship with our boss and we just want to make the best box ever, then we're going to take the information and we're going to say, this is going to help me just be a bit better tomorrow than I am today.